This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 19th, 2024. I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, considering the future of reproductive rights in Arkansas.
I don't want anybody to ever need these services. I want them to be unnecessary and unthinkable, but they can't be illegal.
Plus, a 15-minute opportunity to help another in the future.
Blood donation is personal to myself because I am a blood recipient. If it wasn't for donors donating blood, I would not be standing here today.
And how co-workers destined for future iconic status inspired a new play.
There's this passage in the book where he talks about the time that he met Red Fox and they were working together at a place called Jimmy's Chicken Shack.
First, the news of the present from NPR.
Support for KUAF comes from Woodstone Pizza, located on South School Avenue and Uptown on Mall Avenue in Fayetteville. Wood-fired pizzas, salads, local beers, and wines available for dine-in and curbside 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday. WoodstoneCraftPizza.com for menus.
It is Wednesday, June 19th, 2024. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. It is Juneteenth. In our second half hour today, Marisa Anderson is bringing her atmospheric guitar sound back to Northwest Arkansas. We'll ask her about the two new records released this year and how she creates titles for instrumental music. First, it's expected for politicians to speak out about proposed amendments, but health professionals and doctors rarely do. When it comes to the Arkansas abortion amendment, however, Dr. Amy Galdamez says she's compelled to speak. She's a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist based in Little Rock, and she recently spoke with Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore via Zoom. She says when she was asked why she decided to talk about the amendment, the answer for her was easy.
My patients. And I've had so many of them say, thank you. Thank you for speaking out. Patients who have been ostracized by their family because of terminations in the past. Again, before June of 22, patients who are worried for their children. They're worried for themselves. They're worried for their spouses. My daughter, my family is complete. She's only 10, my daughter and her friends and her entire population. I don't want anybody to ever need these services. I want them to be unnecessary and unthinkable, but they can't be illegal.
From your professional perspective, what are some misconceptions people may have about abortions and even perhaps what constitutes an abortion?
A phenomenal question. That's a big challenge is how we define a lot of these procedures and how we define a lot of these labels. Medically, an abortion is any sort of ending of a pregnancy. And that could be either spontaneous, where a body ends it for whatever reason. A miscarriage is how most people would consider that. But we call those spontaneous abortions. An induced abortion would be where we are ending the pregnancy. And that could be in any way from a medication to a procedure to a labor induction. I mean, even depending on, again, how you define it, and that's what gets so tricky when you start trying to legislate a lot of this, you know, labor inductions with the plan for palliative care and not NICU resuscitation, in certain cases, those could be considered abortions. The challenge becomes the language that's used, and most lay people, and I can't speak for all, obviously, and as a medical professional, it's difficult to sort of unlearn that, right? I think most people assume that those are procedures that people do because they just don't want to be pregnant anymore. And that's a vast oversimplification in how we use various, again, medications or procedures when appropriate for healthcare.
In a world before Roe was overturned, I imagine you oversaw abortions. Can you talk about what did those procedures look like and maybe what was the emotional state of the situation? Because I think that's something we can kind of take for granted, is there's a bit of an assumption, as you pointed out, that abortions are always wanted.
Excellent. And so a lot of that, even before June of 22, a lot of that depended on your facility, where you had privileges to operate, to deliver, and a lot of those were governed by those facilities. So, for example, I've got a precious patient who's actually about to deliver her very, very precious baby here in a few weeks. But back in 2019, she had a new breast cancer diagnosis. And after lots of research on the tumor itself, and tumor markers and counseling with her oncologists and her breast surgeons over at CARTI, the best chemotherapy for her actually was the one chemotherapy that would have been very teratogenic. And teratogenic is the word for could have really hurt her baby. So despite her having a very wanted pregnancy back in 2019, by early 2020, the best thing with her team, her cancer team, me, her husband, her pastor, our team, the decision was made together to go ahead and terminate her and this initial pregnancy, let her fight her cancer and then pursue. So I spoke with our administration here at Baptist and was able to offer it here. Yes, it was legal, but the facility had a couple of rules. And so I offered that. She was 12 weeks. Yes, it was emotionally devastating. It was horrific. I had some OR staff who couldn't be there. The procedure itself is very similar to what we do during a miscarriage. So there's not much at that gestational age, not much different technically compared to how you handle a miscarriage, but the emotion is much different, right? And so I had OR staff that needed to excuse themselves. And of course there, that was supported and that was fine. And afterwards, after everything was stable and my patient was taken care of course I cried with her, of course. But she was able to fight her cancer and get pregnant again. And she's, I'm doing her C-section in 2 weeks.
So let's continue the hypothetical here then. Let's say that the patient that you had in 2019 who had cancer, if that happened now, what would your options be?
I'll be frank. I live in a little bit of a bubble where my patients typically have privilege. They have commercial insurance, they have resources. And so I admit that my patient population is such that and they have left the state. They have gone to Kansas, to Chicago, to the Illinois side of St. Louis, to Denver, to Portland, because these things are happening, right? Breast cancer didn't stop happening after June of 22. I haven't had that exact situation, but I'm sure others have. Since June of 22, I've had patients who have had fetuses, very wanted pregnancies with pretty significant chromosomal abnormalities diagnosed early on that are really incompatible, typically, and of course there are exceptions, typically incompatible with life, who have opted to, again, go ahead and wrap that pregnancy up rather than let it progress, let our moms get, you know, into higher risk time periods. And they've gone to Wichita, they've gone to Chicago. I had one that was diagnosed with some pretty impressive heart defects that weren't going to be real compatible with surgery afterwards. And she went to Denver. It's been challenging. And again, I admit that my patients typically have those resources and have those connections and feel comfortable talking to me about what their options are. And we can work together to find those resources. But not every woman can take a week off of her job, these procedures out of state.
Earlier, you said when it comes to the nuances and gray areas of what is and isn't an abortion, that you should let us decide. By us, you mean the medical professionals instead of the politicians?
Yes. And we understand that these are not to be taken lightly. We understand that there are physical and medical and emotional complications that can happen. And we understand that these are not risk-free procedures to undergo. But in certain cases, risk and benefits being weighed, it makes medical sense. And so we have to be able to do that. If we get tied up in a case, we can't take care of our patients. And so we are living in fear going, does this count? Will I be the first one? Is there going to be a phone call from an attorney who got an anonymous tip from somebody who didn't understand what we were really doing and thought that we were doing an illegal abortion when we weren't? I mean, we do DNCs on labor and delivery for retained placentas. What if a nursing student sees the word DNC and misunderstands? And anyway, those are silly, but that's the environment that we've been living in, is going, we just want to take care of our patients. We don't want anybody to rely on pregnancy termination as their family planning method of choice. We understand that's inappropriate and unsound medical advice, but we just want to be able to take care of our patients in those hopefully really rare times, but when it's needed locally.
I don't think it's silly to think in those terms because, I mean, this is your livelihood that you're concerned about. I think it's very rational to think that someone could misconstrue language that they've heard online or they've heard in the media of their choosing, and perhaps they're, you know, someone looking for a bone to pick, and it just takes one person to ruin your professional career.
Potentially. I mean, I've that happened again Friday. By Saturday, I was texting attorney friends saying, I need to know who to call if I get a phone call from a prosecuting attorney. I've had that number saved my phone. I haven't needed it, but that's ridiculous. No other medical profession has to worry about that. No other medical profession has to worry if they opt for palliative care or hospice care that they might be called a felon.
Do you worry that you may lose some of your patients because of your stance?
No, I don't. I really don't. And I think part of that is because I've tried to be so moderate, tried to be so appropriate. Let's not be flippant about terminations. You know, we understand that they are big deals, and that we understand that they should be used judiciously. And part of it is that I haven't yet. I mean, my article came out in March and my phone's still ringing. And I have actually had more patients say, thank you. Thank you for standing up for us. Thank you for standing up for my daughter and my sister. Thank you for being a voice. And admittedly, I've not been involved much in politics at all. And most doctors are. Most doctors are too busy. We've got too many patients and too many responsibilities and charts to sign. And, you know, the phone's ringing right now from the high-risk unit. It's, you know, we've got too much to do. But this was one of those things that I just had to do. And I talked to my husband and my partners here at my office. And my husband said, well, why does it have to be you? I said, well, it has to be somebody. And my partners, they said, thank you. Go, please be a voice. If you feel called, we support you. And before I've done anything, I've not asked for permission, but out of respect, asked for their support. And I've gotten nothing but phenomenal support.
Have you heard directly from folks who were opposed to this amendment?
I've gotten a couple of comments of, I can't believe you would ever be pro-abortion. And that's inaccurate, correct? Like, I'm not pro-abortion. Nobody's pro-abortion. Nobody thinks this sounds like fun today. That's an inappropriate argument. It creates more of an emotional response than a true thoughtful response. And so I have had a couple. Usually it's let's sit down and talk about this. And after we do, they kind of go, well, I guess I get where you're coming from. I just still don't like abortion. And I say, I don't either. I don't want anybody to ever need it. But the reality is these things are going to happen. And we're going to have, I've got a very complicated kidney disease patient who is terrified that she's going to get pregnant again. She's already had two very high-risk pregnancies, and she's terrified, but she's not sure if she wants to go through with permanent sterilization yet, and she's still very young, but she is just terrified that she may have a birth control failure or have a condom break, and she's just going, what do I do? Do I just live in fear? Do I just, you know, abstain for the rest of my life? And we're talking about that. My husband will get the guy at the golf course saying, hey, my wife wants to tell your wife, thank you. You know, and he's just going, cool. Okay. And my kids will come home from school and say, hey, Miss So-and-so wants me to tell you, thank you. And so I'm getting way more support in places unanticipated than any sort of real meaningful negative criticism.
Does that surprise you?
A bit, but very pleasantly surprised. And it just sort of, again, when you sit down and you have conversations about real people, these aren't hypotheticals, they're not theoreticals. These are real women who have challenging situations that they have to navigate. When you really make it real, most people are going, oh, well, that's different. Oh, well, I guess that's that one's okay. And I say, well, that's the point. That's the point. So again, a little surprised, but pleasantly surprised and very pleased to see that most people go, I never thought of it that way. And I had a patient January, I think, and this came up and told her how sad I was for a patient that had to leave the state for this. And she goes, I just can't believe any woman would ever want to do that. And I said, we're going to talk about that. No woman wants to do that. No woman looks forward to that. But let me explain some situations. And this is a very conservative patient I've taken care of for a decade. And she sat there real still, bless her heart, in her little gown in the office. And she goes, thank you. Thank you for adding humanity back to the conversation. I never thought about it that way. I really appreciate that. And it just gave me chills. And it's just I've been pleasantly surprised by even my very conservative patients that have gone, I just never thought of it that way. I just had been told, that that was for women who made bad choices, or women who didn't think things through, or women who, all kinds of unfortunate assumptions. And to add that humanity back to the conversation, I think is critical.
Amy, this is the last question I have for you. If you had an opportunity to talk to lawmakers, specifically here on the state level, what would you want them to know about how abortion works and why it's so important to have an amendment like this?
Because it's so personal. And there are so many pieces to that risk-benefit decision that is so unique to each case. Everything from a patient's age to her gestational age to her diagnosis, there are too many nuances and too many gray areas to adequately legislate this. There's too much. And thankfully, we have medical professionals who know all the too much, and we're okay with the too much. And we've got this, and we love our patients, and we want the best things for them. So let us do those.
Dr. Amy Gamaldez is a board-certified OBGYN based in Little Rock. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore last week via Zoom. This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks brought its mobile donation center, the Bloodmobile, to Fayetteville's downtown square. Ozarks at Large's Jack Travis visited the Bloodmobile to learn more and to give back.
As I approached the Bloodmobile last Wednesday, June 10th, I felt more than a little nervous. I was going to donate blood, and let me go ahead and get this out of the way. I don't do well with needles. But I had decided I would face my fears. I was going to prove to anyone who might feel a similar fear to mine that it was okay, and maybe even rewarding. This may be obvious, but I had never donated blood before, and it's very likely you haven't either. According to the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks, only 3% of the population gives blood, and for Northwest Arkansas in particular, that small percentage makes a substantial impact.
I think CBCO is one of the best kept secrets in Northwest Arkansas. Until someone has been impacted by the need for blood, most people don't think about where does this blood come from? How did it get to me?
That's Greg Womack. He's a blood drive consultant for the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks, and he says when you donate with the CBCO, you're saving the lives of your neighbors.
We supply every single unit of blood to every hospital in Northwest Arkansas. So anyone who donates blood with Community Blood Center of the Ozarks, that blood is going to help someone at one of our hospitals here locally. And that's not to say other blood banks shouldn't be supported. It's just nice for our donors, our sponsor groups, the media, city leaders, and community leaders to know that our blood bank is actually the sole source of blood for our hospitals and our patients here. So anyone that gives blood with Community Blood Center of the Ozarks, they know it's going to help someone here.
That means that the CBCO provided every drop of blood to all 45 hospitals in the organization's 41 county service area. For example, Washington Regional in Fayetteville received 7,912 units in 2023. A unit of blood is roughly equivalent to one pint, which might be further divided to use its different components, like plasma and platelets.
It's a good thing to give back to the community, and blood donation is personal to myself because I am a blood recipient. If it wasn't for donors donating blood, I would not be standing here today.
Bonnie Bollinger is the senior administrative assistant for the Fayetteville Mayor's Office. She's facilitated city-sponsored blood drives with the CBCO for the past 15 years. She says that community blood drives are especially helpful during the summer months when donations tend to slow down.
Normally in the summertime, blood donations are lower because everybody's off on vacation and school kids are out of school, so people are out traveling. But our blood drives seem like they're pretty constant, pretty steady as far as the number of donors that come out. But I have noticed, like today, our appointments are a little bit lower.
Greg says the CBCO organizes many education-based drives throughout the school year at elementary schools, high schools, colleges, and universities. Those school-centered drives supply roughly 3/4 of the blood collected by the CBCO.
So all of those sources of blood donations go away, and so we have a lot fewer groups to donate to support the local blood supply June, July, and August. So we rely a lot more on our community blood drives, just like the city of Fayetteville, because they're year-round. So we really depend heavily on those groups for those 3 months of the year.
If you can't attend a community blood drive, you can always visit the CBCO donor centers in Bentonville and Springdale. You can go to cbco.org for more information about their donor centers and other community blood drives occurring throughout the summer. Okay, now it's time to face the music, or in this case, the IV. When I entered the Bloodmobile, the friendly staff told me to fill out a survey regarding my medical history. They then ushered me into a smaller room to run some tests on my hemoglobin numbers, blood pressure, and pulse. Before I knew it, I was in a chair, being swabbed with an antiseptic as an attendant prepped my vein for donation.
So now I'm letting air dry for 30 seconds. Squeeze and hold. You know where Shawash has the time for you to turn your head?
Oh, yeah.
Gently squeeze every 3 to 5 seconds. It is normal for you to feel that sting.
Once my vein was tapped, the process felt quick. And after about 10 minutes, I was out the door, snacking on some Cheez-Its and Powerade. It was nothing. Plus, I would receive an email informing me of my blood type, cholesterol levels, and other vitals. The CBCO even has a program called Thank the Donor that allows the recipient of your blood the chance to send you an anonymous message of gratitude. You can visit our website, ozarksatlarge.com, for more information about the CBCO and where you can find a blood drive near you. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jack Travis.
Jack Travis put that piece together in the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 1. The second weekend of the 2024 Arkansas New Play Festival is underway tomorrow night. This year's collection of playwrights includes West Coast-based playwright Sarah Guerrero with her work Have to Believe We Are Magic, A.K. Payne, a recent graduate of Yale School of Drama, and recent Obie winner Sarah Gancher. There is also new work from Springdale-based Latinx Theater Project and returning to the festival this year, Jonathan Norton, with his new script, Malcolm X and Red Fox Washing Dishes at Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem. Yesterday, Jonathan and Dexter J. Singleton, who is the director of new play development at Theater Squared and co-producer of the New Play Festival, came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about this weekend's presentations of new work. Singleton says the process of finding works for the festival includes selecting a mix of scripts by topic, author, and voices. And he says choosing plays also means imagining the transition of the words on a page to a public presentation.
Plays are meant to be seen and not necessarily just read, even though we know that's part of with all pieces of literature. And so in every case, generally, I see the play and I read the play and I have to imagine what it would be like to see it and what it would be like for someone that's an audience member without the knowledge that I have. So I have to look at it, right, like you say, multidimensional, and think about, okay, how would someone who didn't know about this play, seeing this for the first time, how might they respond to this? So what we always find when we get to the first set of readings, which were just this past weekend, Bob and I always say to one another, wow, this play is, I didn't know this part was as funny, or I didn't know this section or this line was going to resonate as deeply with people, or that people would have this much emotion here or there. And so that always is interesting to see, and often very surprising, is how people respond to individual moments, lines, characters in a play.
I bet that's exciting.
Absolutely, yes, extremely exciting. I mean, I love new work. It's my favorite thing to work on, and to see that response and to know that a play is just in its opening stages or its first couple of drafts, and know that they're really excited about this now. But once this playwright really gets an opportunity to continue to work on it, you know, for the next couple of months or the next year or whenever, it's going to be so much better.
Jonathan, let's talk about, for a playwright, going from two to three dimensions. What's it like to see a new work in a atmosphere like this?
Actually, I was telling someone earlier today that my first experience with the festival for this play, Malcolm X and Red Fox, Washington Dishes at Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem, was Sunday. I had previously been at Alabama Shakespeare Festival for another workshop. And so Sunday was my first day in, and the first thing I had to experience was the first reading. And that was such an amazing experience for me, and a new experience to have to come in on a reading of one of my plays when I hadn't been involved in like the workshop the week prior, because I was actually able to hear the play with really fresh ears, incredibly fresh ears. And I learned so much about the play from that process that I think was, in many ways, it's just, in a lot of ways, equally as valuable as had I been there like the entire week, because I think that there are things that I might have anticipated and I had no ability to anticipate anything. So that was a new experience for me, and I'm happy that it worked out in that way, oddly enough.
I'm intrigued merely by the title of the play, which is part of what you want to do, without giving away too much, because I'm going to Sunday's reading, so I don't want to know too much about it. But what can you tell me about the inspiration?
There's two stories here. So the first story is Theater Squared commissioned me to write a new play for them. And last summer, when I was here for the new play festival, I was kind of in the process of trying to figure out and conceive what that might be. And at that time, I believe I had been thinking a lot about wanting to write a play about Malcolm X and Maya Angelou and the time that they spent together in Ghana. And I struggled with it and struggled with it and struggled with it so badly. For two reasons. A, because Maya Angelou, she wrote so prolifically about her life that it's really hard to like dramatize or theatricalize someone's life when they've written that much about their life. It's just really difficult. And the other thing I struggled with was that as of yet, I have not had the privilege to visit Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt really conflicted about that. And so I was dealing with that, struggling with that, and continuing to read about Malcolm, continuing to read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And there's this passage in the book where he talks about the time that he met Red Fox.
The comedian.
And they were working together at a place called Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem. And I was like, oh my God, there's a play in there somewhere. And I emailed Dexter and was like, Dexter, I think I have an idea.
What'd you say when you got that email, that idea?
I thought that was brilliant. First thing I asked, like everyone is asked when they've heard about the play and its title and what it contains, is they actually knew each other? They worked together? And that place as well, Jimmy's Chicken Shack, you know, Harlem was just thriving artistically at that point and had been for several years at that point. And so many people came through the walls of that restaurant, you know, other folks who work there, lots of musicians who are world-class famous musicians, Charlie Bird Parker, and so many others, right, that we know, Art Tatum, and just all these, you know, just incredible musicians, and they were all just starting out. A lot of them were young, just trying to get established, just trying to figure out their style and what they wanted to do and the impact they wanted to make artistically. They just happened to all be coming through this place in Harlem at that time, and so it's an era we know in history that hasn't, you know, been highlighted enough. Because some of the most brilliant artists in the world have come out of that Harlem era from the Renaissance and then following that era that have just had such a profound impact on arts across the world.
Jonathan, one last question about these fresh ears. So you take them in there. This is your work. You've been working on it. And I just wonder what the process is for you. If maybe a line doesn't hit with this early audience like you think or something like that, What does that do for you in the days after you've watched or listened with fresh ears?
Yes. It allows me the opportunity to sit. I try to sit with my thoughts and my feelings regarding what I've just experienced, what I just heard in the reading. And then it becomes really a conversation with Dexter, a conversation with the actors in our play. I'm always really big on trying to have a sense of inquiry, a deep sense of inquiry, and really also being really thoughtful and specific about a particular challenge that I want to address. I think one of the things that can happen sometimes for a playwright when you're in a workshop type situation, if you're not careful, you can have this this attitude of like, I'm going to fix all the problems. I am going to address every issue in the play. And you really can't do that, you know. You really have to go into a process like this with a really clear punch list of things that you feel that you can achieve and investigate in the time that you have.
Yeah, because one early audience shouldn't determine everything. Like, okay, that didn't hit there, but you can't change everything. So I'm sure that's why a sounding board and conversations works. Like, no, hang on, don't do that. Don't change that.
We had that conversation yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we'll hear different responses because it'll be completely different. And that's a great part about having a 2-week festival, right? Is that, and everybody having two readings and two different locations, because you will get different responses from each of those audiences based on who was there, their knowledge of the subject, personal experience, how they connect to characters. We also did this show. We did a reading of it. We've been working on it, you know, like Jonathan said, it's commissioned by Theater Squared. And so we've been working on this play quite a while, he and I, the different drafts, but we did a reading of it with Primary Stages in New York City in April. And so that was a different response than we heard from that audience than we did even this past weekend. And we know that in a few days, the response at Theater Squared will be even different from that. So it's like you kind of take a collection and a tally of all of those different audiences and moments and responses and then have to filter it out and say, okay, what, you know, like Jonathan said, what do we, you know, want to focus on, and then what can we leave, you know, for later.
Dexter J. Singleton is the director of New Play Development at Theater Squared and co-producer of the Arkansas New Play Festival at T2. And Jonathan Norton's Malcolm X and Red Fox Washing Dishes at Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem is one of the new scripts included in the 2024 Arkansas New Play Festival, continuing tomorrow night through Sunday. A full schedule can be found at ArkansasNewPlayFest.com. This is Ozarks at Large. According to a new report from the United Nations, the number of people forcibly displaced from their homes worldwide has risen to nearly 120 million. Ahead of World Refugee Day tomorrow, we're hearing stories from some refugees who have resettled in Northwest Arkansas.
My name is Saratiel Mugisha. I was born in Rwanda, but I grew up in Kenya, that is in East Africa, as a refugee in Kakuma refugee camp. What happened in Rwanda, like 1994 with genocide, we moved like with our parents to like northern part of Rwanda near Congo, but that's where we lost our dad, like moved to another country that we didn't know since we were in the camp. Things got a little better, we went back to our homeland, but arriving where we were staying, things also were not easy, and by that time we were not without dad, and also during that locomotion, moving people, many refugees. Also, at the same time, we lost our two elder sisters. So it was kind of shocking, grieving, but so when we back home, we stayed like, that was like 1996, but things were not that easy because we found like our homes were taken over by other people. It was hard for us to stay. So and the issue of insecurity was really hard. Yeah, youths were dying every day, and so we decided again to move. In 1999, we moved again to Tanzania. So we worked like for almost like 2 weeks. So at the age, I was something like 9 years. So working for a week and a half, my legs were swollen. I got nothing to eat, but we made it to Tanzania, where we stayed like for 2 weeks. Again, we moved to Kenya. That was, in 2000, to start a new life. Yeah, for the first experience, for sure, it was kind of, I was happy that at least I was in a new place. But also on the other hand, I was kind of panicking with a little fear because it was a new place. I don't know anybody. So I was imagining how am I going to start a new life without people I know. So the only person I knew was my case manager, and maybe we'd meet like maybe twice a week. And so it was hard for me. So after 2 weeks and a half, my permanent house was ready where I was supposed to stay. I moved in my apartment. So from there, that's when I started meeting some, other refugees. Like I would call like maybe to interpret for them. At times also I started going to English classes. So that is when I started like to feel okay. And for me, like when I arrived, it was like winter coming in and going to English classes. I remember I would go when it was snowing. I would fall down, wake up again because it was my first time to see snow, walking in the snow. So I would fall down and wake up again. So you find that being a refugee is a challenge. Yeah, and most of the places were not recognized. I myself, when I finished college, I could search for a job, but I would be denied. You go to say, hey, you are a refugee, you cannot be here. Some people might subscribe like refugees to be maybe bad people, I don't know, but it's not that way. You know, there are refugees are people like others, very hardworking, and there are people who have passed through challenges, which they are willing to work hard to do that. Yeah, like for me, especially, I would do anything to remove that word as a refugee to me. Yeah, so these people also need love and care, and also be given a chance to prove themselves.
Saratiel Mugisha spoke with us at Canopy NWA in Fayetteville. Canopy will host a World Refugee Day event tomorrow from 2 until 7 p.m. on Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville. If you'd like more details, Canopy NWA on Facebook. Saturday night, Big Sister Studio will be hosting Fashion Fit for a Queen. It's a tribute concert and fashion cabaret at The Medium in Springdale. It's meant to be a celebration of the band Queen's legacy and impact on both music and fashion, and it will feature a slew of local designers and artists. Ozarks at Large's Sophia Narani spoke with Big Sister's Brandy Lee about what attendees can expect to see at the show, as well as featured designer and drag artist Jonas, also known as Faux La Beau.
How was Fashion Fit for being conceptualized, and how did it come together?
Yeah, so this all kind of got built around the band, actually. The lead singer of the band is a close friend of mine and my husband's, and the last time we saw them in Austin, we actually had another friend that was with us that hadn't seen them in a while, and he was having the literal time of his life. And I was like, this is what I want people to feel like at fashion shows. Like, I want them just to feel like they're just having so much fun. And simultaneously, I was asking the lead singer, what is it going to take to get you guys to Northwest Arkansas? And he was like, I don't know. And I was like, okay, so you're basically telling me that I need to get a grant, right? And he's like, whatever you have to do. And so after that, those two kind of thoughts were swirling around together. And I took some time and I listened to pretty much the entire discography of Queen and really started to formulate these ideas of what it looks like to pair fashion with the music and how that could look on stage and what kind of garments you would need. And my background is in theater. And so immediately it was like, oh, I'm seeing like stage production, and I love Cabaret, the musical. And so it was just kind of all of that happened all together, and it just rolled into what we see today.
Jonas, let's talk a little bit about yourself and your work, as well as what you're going to be doing in the show.
And my name is Jonas, also known as Folabo, and I am one of the killer queens, the drag queens performing, but also designer, so I'm putting in several pieces of my own. Yeah, so I have been a drag queen for about 8 years now, and I started in Wichita, Kansas, and then I moved here in May of 2020 to start my degree at the University of Arkansas, my master's. Previously, as a drag queen, I just got all of my clothes from Goodwill or anywhere I could find something that was, you know, maybe a little bit shinier than just a regular t-shirt. And when I moved to Fayetteville, I found that I really wanted to change who I was as a performer. I thought that I needed to elevate my craft in some way. And sewing was something that I was interested in, so I took that up. I took zero sewing classes. It was January of 2021, and it was my New Year's resolution to learn how to sew. And it just came naturally. And I think it helped that I liked it and I had a reason to sew. I know a lot of people pick up sewing just because they want to learn, but they don't really have a purpose for it. And for me, I had something I wanted to put outfits on to go and perform. And so I taught myself how to sew, and it picked up very quickly. So with it only being 3 years now, I've gotten to sew for myself, a lot of friends, some minor works and stuff. And this is actually my first time putting anything in a fashion show, thanks to Brandy. So I was really fortunate for Brandy to reach out and say, hey, like, I know you don't maybe put clothes in a fashion show often or anything like that, or consider yourself a designer, but I would love to showcase your work. And that really opened a door for me, which I really appreciated. And so I'm putting in several of my own pieces that I made for myself, and just getting to show off when fashion meets drag. And I think that's kind of my style, and I'm very excited to show it.
And Jonas's pieces are, go find him on Instagram, and I promise you, you'll just be blown away. His pieces were actually inspired me a little bit from Gina Galena's Art Ball, because I feel like a lot of his pieces are not just where fashion meets drag, but fashion meets art as well. And so that was one of the components that we're going to showcase in the show as well. So, yeah.
Can you give me some more details about the other artists involved and what we can expect to see at the event itself?
Yeah. So overarching, I'm just sort of saying, like, this is like fashion show meets rock show meets musical. So we are going to have a live band on stage. And then while the band is playing the song, that's when the fashion component will come. And some of the numbers, the fashion component will be mixed with a little bit of musical. So maybe there's a little dance number. And then we actually do have some formal dancers that are in the show. Save Me actually is, we are pairing up with Novel Dance Co, and they are stepping in and they're going to do the whole number. And so those are professional dancers. We also have two swing dancers that are coming that are going to be a part of the show. And we also have a pole dancer from Diva Dive.
It is Pride Month. Is there a significance of you wanting to hold it on this date and, you know, tying it into Queen?
Definitely from the beginning, the goal for the show was to really honor Freddie. There is a Queen musical that I'm just not really a fan of, because it doesn't really shine a light on just how eccentric Freddie was and how avant-garde Queen is in the music landscape. And I really wanted it to represent that part of Freddie. And so definitely designing it from the very beginning to like really be, you know, gender positive, body positive, sex positive. And then obviously, you know, that's how I was like, I gotta have these drag queens in here because I just think also with the queens specifically, they are they're a triple threat. Like, people just don't give them enough credit for, they can do hair, they can do makeup, they can style their clothes, they can dance, they can perform. And so I was just like, this is a no-brainer there. And then as far as like having it on this day, I actually kind of got lucky. This is being funded by the Cash Exchange Fund grant, which is presented by the Tyson Family Foundation. And they sort of, once you apply for the grant, you sort of get roped into a specific date. But I like to think of it as just sort of divine intervention that it all happened the way it happened. And when I did get the date, the other top thing that I wanted to make super important was that I wanted to make part of the proceeds go directly to NWA Equality, because I just don't think, I just couldn't see a world where I would have a show like this and not make a donation of some sort to that organization, especially during this month.
Is there a specific place you want to direct people for more information and for getting tickets?
Yeah, they can get tickets at shopbigsister.com. It's pretty much the first thing that comes up. It's also, there's a link in my bio on my Instagram. And so people can get it there, and yeah.
All right, Jonas, and what's your Instagram and social? Where can people find you?
Yeah, so my social media is all linked to my drag persona, and so my Instagram is FauxLBEAU, Faux LeBeau, all one word, and that has all of my posts. You can also find me at Facebook under the same name, and those are really the only two social medias that I use, but I will hopefully also have a website coming in the, you know, next couple months and stuff.
For more information about Big Sister Studio or about getting tickets for Fashion Fit for a Queen, shop BigSister.com. For more on Faux LeBeau and their work, you can visit their Instagram and Facebook pages at FauxLBEAU. Marisa Anderson is coming back to Northwest Arkansas. The Portland, Oregon-based guitarist last played here in the fall of 2022. She'll be at the Creamery on West Birch in Rogers tomorrow night. Last week, during a stop in Nashville, she talked with me about what's already been a busy year. She's released two records. One, a collaboration with percussionist Jim White, and the other one included this music for the soundtrack to the sparse film, A Perfect Day for Caribou.
I've done some scoring before, not necessarily for feature, and this was the first time where I've worked with the director in the studio. So Jeff Rutherford, who was the director of the film, he booked, I think, 3 days, maybe 4 days in a studio in Vancouver, Washington, across the river from where I live. And we went in together, and he would show me the scene that he wanted music for, and he would talk to me about what he wanted, how he felt. He was directing me. And we had had several previous conversations, and during those I had kind of done some gathering of like what other work of mine inspired him to ask me to do this film. And so I went in informed with sort of what his taste is or what he was looking for. And then we worked together with the picture to make the music. So he would, you know, run a cut of it and I would be playing live to it, and then afterwards, he'd be like, this worked, that didn't work, go back, do it more this way, dig in over there. It was a super interesting process for me, and it was really difficult because I don't usually work in like an 8-hour block, you know, but he had the studio time blocked like that, and he was taking advantage of every minute of it, so it was intense.
There's another record that came out just in the last month, Swallowtail, that you recorded with Jim White, not the first time the two of you have worked together. I really like the Bitterroot Valley Suites 1, 2, and 3 that are subtitled Water, Tree, and Wind. Do you remember the inspiration behind that?
Yeah. During the pandemic shutdown, I went on a 6-day kayaking trip in the Upper Missouri River, which is in eastern Montana. And on the way back, to my home in Portland, we took some, we got off the freeway and took some back roads, and we went through part of the Bitterroot Valley. And it's a it's a beautiful place, as Montana is a beautiful state. I mean, it's one of, you know, a zillion beautiful places in Montana. But for some reason, when, you know, I was listening back to that piece of music after we had recorded it, some really particular vision of that road came into my head, like, immediately. And so I went with it, because naming instrumental music is ridiculously difficult. And if something comes in your head, you grab it.
One of my favorite records is Cloud Corner. And I just love...
Thank you.
Yeah, I love how from composition to composition, from song to song, there can be different sounds. And I was looking at all of the different instruments you played on that, and there's one, and I'm not going to get the pronunciation, I don't think, right, but a quinto guitar?
You're close. Requinto.
Requinto. Yeah. It's a smaller guitar, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it's not exactly a guitar, but it is a guitar-shaped stringed instrument. It's a small instrument. It's from the Veracruz coast of Mexico, and it's used in a type of music called San Jarocho music. And I have one that was built by a builder down there, and it's a very beautiful instrument. And the quality of its voice is really, it's got a very special quality, that instrument. It kind of sounds like a nylon string guitar, but it has something else to it.
When you're on tour, when you're traveling, are you able to compose, or is that a different sort of element of your life at a different time?
Yeah, it's pretty different. Those things happen in really different spaces. Traveling, touring is pretty consuming, and the exhaustion that sets in after a few nights makes it really hard to be creative beyond what's required for the show. You know, and also I'm very focused. When I'm touring, I'm focused on the music that I'm bringing to the stage each night. And in the case of when I travel with Jim White, you know, we're improvising on stage. So I'm very, like, all the energy that I have for music making goes into those moments. And the more, like, exploratory creative side, so that's the solo part of my solo practice, is not really accessible to me.
Your official bio, you know, mentions that you have played in country and jazz bands. It also says a circus band.
Yep.
What, I mean, circus band, is that what it sounds like?
Yeah, like the band that accompanies the circus?
Yeah, yeah. I guess so.
Yeah, that is what it sounds like. This was years ago, like probably, oh gosh, more than 20 years ago, but yeah.
So acrobats and the like?
I was involved in, trapeze artists, acrobats, clowns, jugglers, no animals, just like giant puppet animals. Yeah. You know, and the one thing that working in live, any kind of live theater settings, you know, whatever the piece of music that you're playing is, you have to time it to the actors, to the circus performers, to whoever is the focus of the audience, right? Like, you're supposed to you're not the focus. You're providing something for the performer to work with or work against. But you know, it teaches you this kind of timing. You know, it's a dance. It's like dancing, that bit.
Marisa Anderson will perform tomorrow night at the Creamery on West Birch in Rogers. Also on that bill, violinist Jack Bird and banjo player Kelby Clark. Doors tomorrow night at 7:30, music scheduled to begin at 8. Much more information available at TrilliumSalonSeries.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville. Today's show was constructed inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Contributors today included Matthew Moore, Jack Travis, Sophia Narani, and Daniel Carruth. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for spending part of your Wednesday with us today. Have a safe and productive rest of your Juneteenth.
Opera in the Ozarks presents its 73rd summer season, June 21st through July 19th, with 22 performances at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs, plus special events in Fayetteville and beyond, featuring 40 premier vocalists from across the nation. This year's operas include La Traviata, The Crucible, Beauty and the Beast, and L'Enfant à la Sortilège. Tickets and season schedule at opera.org.